For much of the more than a week now since the tsunami and earthquake hit Japan, the stories we have been hearing have come from English-speaking correspondents in the disaster zone, interviewing survivors and spokesmen and voicing over the still terrifying pictures coming out of the worst affected areas.
All of a sudden, in the middle of the street, seemingly coming out of nowhere, you have this house. It just seems dumped right here in the middle of the street. And if you go over here and start to get a look inside, you get a sense of remembrances of what this life was like for the people who lived here. Kids' books on the ground scattered, a jigsaw puzzle over here.
Sanjay Gupta there on CNN. There's so much about the individual stories of what happened on March 11th that we don't know and may never know. As I saw the horrible pictures of those waves flattening towns in northeast Japan, I thought about the 30 minutes or so warning people got. But as someone who can't walk and relies on a wheelchair to move, I could immediately see that 30 minutes was no warning time. What happened to the people with disabilities? And there are thousands of people who lived in northeast. Who made it out? Who didn't? We found Shoji Nakanishi, a disabled activist in Tokyo, coordinating relief for the most vulnerable. He sounded sick and weary from running down leads last night. And many of the stories are heartbreaking. Here, Shoji, in polite, halting English, tells the fate of one muscular dystrophy guy in a wheelchair.
A muscular dystrophy guy, a tsunami came, and his elder sister went to his house and went to rescue him. But the tsunami came, and two of them is in the sea. But the elder sister, fortunately, hit on the electricity pole, and she climbed up the pole. She was saved, but that younger brother was missed in the sea.
Shoji and his wife, Yokiko, have been working nonstop to locate and evacuate disabled victims of the disaster. Of the thousands of people believed in harm's way, they had managed by last night to have gotten only 37 people out. Most of the stories Yokiko told us last night were like this one, a wheelchair in swirling waters and then separation.
One wheelchair person, he tried to be evacuated together with the family, but the tsunami came and it was too late for them to escape, and the wheelchair was taken away, and that family who pushed the wheelchair could grab something nearby, and then they were separated.
Yukiko says in Tokyo, the shelter for the lucky ones is still difficult, and many survivors have chosen to stay where they are.
Shelter itself that is not so much accessible and very much congested, so that it's very difficult to stay for the wheelchair users, so that even if that their house is destroyed, they continue to stay in the house, or they stayed in the car if they have.
Survivors living in abandoned cars. And Yukiko says quietly living with a polite humility, characteristic of rural northeast Japan, that is itself part of the story.
The people living in the local city are in most cases not so demanding. They hesitate to express their feelings, even if they have a lot of requests that they didn't express it right now.
Among the most difficult ironies we learned of is that for the dozens of personal assistants for people with severe disabilities who stayed with their clients, even risking their own lives when they might have easily escaped the floods, the Japanese government fired them all once they reached the special shelter, until Yokiko and Shoji intervened.
Government still had the red tape, but they tried to change the law, for example, that personal assistance cannot be used for the person that are living in the inside the hospital. Because we negotiated, and we told them that this is matter of the life and death, so that at last it was allowed.
Finally, the personal scars from this disaster are distinct for some disabled people who were abandoned by their families during the flood, waters that have in some cases divided families for good. Listen carefully to Shoji here calmly speaking about a blind person survivor, abandoned by family, rescued, but now bitter.
The family member approached our team to meet with him, but he refused to meet with some family member again. This kind of problem happened day by day.
We left Shoji and Yukiko Nakanishi last night to resume their painstaking work. Everyday news stories of survival and loss. A small human piece of a story in Japan that is still unfolding, changing lives forever. Joining us to conclude this hour on The Takeaway is Dan Sloan, correspondent for Reuters in Japan. Dan, we're going to be hearing more and more stories of individual survivors, especially among the most vulnerable. What have you heard?
Well, in addition to, obviously, those with disabilities in this region, certainly northern Japan is well known for its rather elderly population, as well as, a sense that the younger people have moved away from those communities. We know the numbers of displaced are over 500,000. And one of the interesting facts, as I was listening to your report, is about 20% of those are children as well. So that,
wow.
That's according to Save the Children. And we really are seeing, with this kind of situation, which remains quite critical, the temporary shelters are often poorly heated and still without some of the most basic supplies until aid gets there, that a number of groups at risk are still the ones that are being the most affected. There was some good news out of one of the hardest hit areas, Ishinomaki, which is very close to the epicenter of the quake. Today, an 80-year-old woman and her 16-year-old grandson were pulled out 9 days after the quake and tsunami. And it's really unbelievable to think anyone could live. And on television tonight, they actually show the facility, which just looked like a pile of rubble. But somehow, there were corridors within the destruction that allowed them to breathe and to stay warm. And eventually, the grandson escaped and found help. So, again, most of the stories are very tragic, but there are still, a few of these kind of miracle tales.
Dan Sloan, correspondent for Reuters, where the headline here in the West, of course, is the nuclear problem spreading to the food supply and trace amounts detected in Tokyo's water supply. Full coverage of the situation in Japan and also the story out of Libya. Dan Sloan, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We've got more information for you at our website, thetakeaway.org, but we want to keep you posted on what's happening in Libya. U.S. missiles have bombed Muammar Gaddafi's compound in a second round of airstrikes in Tripoli this morning. The Pentagon says Gaddafi himself is not a target, and the airstrikes are aimed at his armed forces and air defense systems. Earlier, the Libyan government said it had ordered another ceasefire. The White House dismissed that announcement. And this morning, eyewitnesses speaking to CNN say Gaddafi's forces are attacking the city of Misrata. Yesterday, Arab League Secretary General Amer Moussa criticized the severity of coalition strikes. He later backed down from those remarks. We're asking, what is your opinion?
My name's Rich Minton from Watertown, Mass. I think it's sad how the same resolve in Libya wasn't shown by us in Darfur.
Give us your take on the situation by calling 8778-MY-TAKE. Special thanks to our tireless producer, Jen Poyant. She helped with that story about disabled victims of this Japanese tsunami. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.